welcome to Radio Oldie, sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors. Looking beyond today's headlines, Baillie Gifford backs exceptional companies driving progress and helping investors benefit from long-term growth. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be talking to our brilliant sports correspondent, Jim White, who also writes for The Telegraph and has covered 7 World Cups. Is that right?
That's right. Since 1998, Harry.
How amazing. And it's striking. We're talking just before the England game against Congo, so you may be listening to it after that game. But do you think England can win the whole thing, notwithstanding that?
I don't, Harry. I'm slightly worried about where they go down the line, even if they get past Congo. It's so difficult. And there are so many traps along the way. And then there's France in the final, who are magnificent. So it would be difficult. If they do it, what an achievement.
Yeah. And you're extremely young and even younger looking, Jim, but you must have been a little boy to remember the 66 World Cup.
I do.
Yep.
I remember the 66 World Cup. And bizarrely, my dad was a great traveller, and he decided that what we were going to do was go on a camping trip along the Rhine. So we were actually in Germany in 66 in the final. And I have this vivid memory of me and my sister, my two sisters and my mum. And my dad had a transistor radio and was trying, this was when the final was on, was trying to communicate what was happening from German radio to us.
Fluent German speaker,
he didn't speak German, no. So it wasn't the greatest of translations. So it was basically trying to pick up what young people would call the vibe. And I remember at one point him saying, "Oh dear, no, that's not good. Somebody called Horst has scored." No, Dad, I think that anyway. It was marvellous, that's my memory, first memory of the World Cup, really,
and
being over there.
And was there something remarkable about that team in that we won it for the only time? Or obviously home advantage made a huge difference, didn't it?
Yes, home advantage made a huge difference. But England's record up to that point had been terrible. The furthest they got was the quarterfinals in 1958. They stuck their noses up and said, we don't want to enter when it first happened. And then they lost against the part-timers at the USA in 1950, and 54 they hadn't done anything, and so they weren't really very good. 62 good players, but hadn't really worked out. It was the combination of some very good players, Bobby Charlton, Bobby Moore, Alan Ball, plus a really, really clever manager, and Alf Ramsey steered them through.
And in recent years, we suffer from the English disease, don't we, of always being down on England. But we have done pretty well, haven't we? We've been there or thereabouts in most tournaments for the last 10 or 15 years. Yet.
Well, we have a huge inferiority complex about the Germans. The Germans have just been knocked out by Paraguay on penalties. We have a great inferiority complex about the Germans, but look at the Germans' recent record. Yes, OK, I'll give it to them. They won it in 2014. 2018 and 2022, they didn't even make it past the group stage, whereas we got to the semi-final and the quarter-final. So, yes, I think the last few World Cups, we've punched about our weight, about level. But the thing is, I think you've got to do something a bit better, a bit more. And the hope is that Thomas Tuchel, manager, has a bit of wile about him, a little bit of tactical nuance, which is slightly reflective of Alf Ramsey, and has an ability within a game which surpasses Gareth Southgate. Gareth Southgate, wonderful man, lovely man, great at making everyone feel good, but not so good at those moments where you've got to be ruthless within a game. And let's hope Tuchel can do it.
And he did apparently give this incredible half-time team talk in the first game, didn't he?
That's right. Yeah. He basically was very dissatisfied with the way they played and said, if we're going to go down, let's go down punching. Let's go down and really show everybody. Be brave. Great words. I'm not quite sure what he said the game after that against Ghana.
They
went very quiet.
Yeah. And you talked about Germany being knocked out. Holland had been knocked out. Is it the case that the lesser teams are getting better? Teams that once would have been minnows are now winning?
This is the great diaspora World Cup. So England are playing DR Congo, and there's a player on DR Congo who went to the same school as England's Marcus Rashford. So a lot of them are schooled within the system. Look at the Morocco team. Absolutely incredibly strong team who knocked out the Netherlands. Half of them went to school in the Netherlands. A lot of them are French-based.
Right.
So this diaspora effect is making some of what we would traditionally think of as the weaker, less experienced teams actually very strong. They know what they're doing. The centre-forward for DR Congo plays for Newcastle United. These are players playing at the very peak of the club game.
So what I had growing up, an expectation that either Holland, Argentina, Germany or France or occasionally Italy would win big tournaments. Maybe not this time will that come to an end, but in the future we can expect a much broader group of countries to win the World Cup.
Whether they win, Harry, that's the question. Whether they've got the spread of talent that Brazil or Argentina or France have got is the question that might come to it. I mean, if you look at the French team at the moment, they've got this wonderful front line, and if one of them, Kylian Mbappe, isn't doing it, then another one will do it. I think they become a bit more reliant on one or two quality players, but then you could say the same about England.
Yeah, and still the gap between, say, Brazil and poor Scotland is palpable, isn't it? That's insuperable, that difference.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And Scotland were pretty miserable against Brazil. It was a depressing moment for those who had any affiliation and affection for Scotland. They've done very well. Everybody loved the fans. No Scotland, No Party was the kind of unofficial soundtrack of the tournament. But the team stacked the place out, let's yeah. be honest. And, yeah. and if you looked at the difference between them and Paraguay, who, you know, really had a go.
There was a sort of terror, wasn't there, which you can see. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing that kind of fear of failure produces failure somehow.
Yeah, as opposed to the plucky have-a-go heroes, which happens with non-league teams knocking out Premiership teams in the FA Cup, etc. And how do you think, since you covered your first World Cup in 98, there has been a huge change in football, hasn't there? I mean, I've supported Arsenal all my life and started going in the 80s. And of course, it's always been very popular, but not on the same massive scale. And is that the money coming in for telly that did that, you think?
Yes, I think it was. What changed it was the start of the Premier League in 1992-93 season. And that, just because it happened to be, the satellite TV company happened to be owned by the same guy who owned the most popular newspapers, to plug
Mr. Murdoch
sales of his satellite dishes, he suddenly enlarged the amount of coverage that was in The Sun, the biggest selling newspaper in the country. And then everyone else had to follow suit, and they were all playing catch up. And suddenly there was this huge explosion of interest in the game. And then you get the interest around players such as David Beckham, which extends and turns them into culturally wide figures. Which didn't really happen. Everybody knows the names of Bobby Charlton and Bobby Moore, but they weren't the kind of figure that David Beckham has become, or Ronaldo or Messi, who are now internationally spread as much by social media as anything. I was watching a documentary the other day about the Ronaldo-Messi competition, and they were saying that the photograph of Messi lifting the World Cup in 2022 was the most liked image in internet history.
That's extraordinary. And that transcends avid football supporters, doesn't it? It's women, many more women watching football and playing football, all ages, all backgrounds. And you don't need to be... I've got friends who are watching the World Cup now who I test whether they really like football by asking if they can explain the offside rule.
I'm not sure I can.
No, of course.
I find it very confusing.
But that, But that doesn't matter. That's fine. But it shows how it's become a thing not just for the obsessive football fans that you and I might have been in our youth. You know,
the really, this is the point. The World Cup has become a kind of social gathering point. This particular World Cup is so elongated, it may take time. But say England got to the semi-final and it's a beautiful summer's evening, the whole country will be in front of big screens or small screens. Everyone will be involved. Everyone will feel that they have a part of it. Everyone will feel that they're being represented by those 11 guys out in the United States. And I think one of the real tests of this, and this is possibly why FIFA wanted the World Cup, is how big it becomes in the United States. Every stadium, these huge American football stadiums that have been converted in by putting grass on the pitch into proper football stadiums, they're full. You know, you're talking.
They are full. Are there stories of empty seats?
But there are empty seats, but yeah. These are stadiums of 80,000, and the empty seats are probably when Jordan took on Algeria or whatever it might have been. The smaller teams in the league games. It'd be really interesting to see whether this finally pushes what they call soccer to the very peak of American interest. The one thing that has fascinated a lot of observers so far has been Donald Trump's absence from it. We were all assuming Donald Trump, who has a brilliant antenna for anything that will give him publicity, would be there standing, ensuring the USA are doing well. Why is he not there? That's for your politics.
Is it because it'd be highly unlikely for them to win the whole thing? Do you think that's the reason? You could only really support something if he knows they're going to be.
Well, I remember going to see the opening game in Russia, in Moscow, and it was Russia against Saudi Arabia, and Russia won 5-0, and the big screen was there. And Putin was sitting next to MBS of Saudi. And obviously instruction had gone to the TV people to point the camera at Putin every time Russia scored. And he was clearly milking it. And so, this goes back, 98, the first World Cup I went to live, I remember being at the semi-final, which was between France and Croatia. And in the press box, just below the press box in the Stade de France, there was a TV camera set up, and I remember this massive scrum at the point where France got to the final. And it was Jacques Chirac, then president, making sure he was in front of the camera at the exact point when the glory could be adopted. And Putin disappeared from the competition the moment Russia were knocked out, clearly.
Right.
He wasn't there for the final, I don't think. But I wonder why. Wonder
no,
why
it's Trump's interesting. Trump has been to the basketball, hasn't he?
He has. Yeah. And he likes his sport. You know, he put up a wrestling centre.
Of course he does.
In the White House.
Yeah. The Oldie is a huge fan of Hebridean Island cruises. Their small ships carry between just 38 and 48 guests around the Scottish islands, lochs, and coastlines. It's all about comfort. Good food, fascinating excursions, and a very personal atmosphere. To discover more and get savings of up to 20%, visit hebridean.co.uk or search for Hebridean Island Cruises. Jim, to talk more generally about your lovely column in the Oldie, what a lot of people say who read it, who aren't naturally sports fans, because what it's talking about football, cricket, all the great sports. You talk about sport more generally. You just wrote a lovely column about a reunion of your Bristol University football team and a brilliant piece about the most unsuccessful athletes of all time at the Commonwealth Games. Can you remind us who they were?
Oh, dear. Oh, Harry, I feel so terrible about
that.
It'd
be nice about them.
It was the triathlon at the Commonwealth Games, and it was in Strathclyde Country Park in Glasgow. And it was a beautiful day. I'll repeat that. It was in Glasgow, and it was a beautiful day. And I remember sitting there, and we were sitting. They started by swimming twice round the lake in there. And the Brownlee brothers were there, and there was a good South African, a good Canadian, a couple of Aussies. They all dive in, and off they go. And then I realised pretty quickly there were a couple of guys doing breaststroke at the back. And they had to go round twice. And they were, first of all, lapped by the Brownies, who appeared to have motors in them. And the Brownies in the leading pack had finished both laps before they'd even completed one. And they were taken out of the water by two stewards in a boat. They'd failed to meet the time. And one was from the Cook Islands. I can't remember where the other was from. And you thought, these poor guys, they've been training. And they came over to compete. And they didn't even get on their bikes.
Because that is... And that is part of the joy and misery of sport, is the triumph and adversity. Not just for famous football players, but for all of us trying these things, or you playing football with your old university friends.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I remember the difference between Britain and the way we watch sport and other countries. I remember being in the big stadium in Beijing in 2008, and there was, I think it was 10,000 metres, but there was a guy who came in very far behind everyone else, a bit like your Cook Islands in that. And the Chinese audience were silent. They were almost embarrassed for him. Whereas you could imagine,
yes,
guy comes in last, he's Eric the Eel. He becomes, yeah, he'll someone will give him a name. He'll be
Eddie
cheered
the Eagle.
To the
yes, yeah.
He'll be cheered to the echo,
yeah,
by a British crowd. We love the gallant loser.
Yeah.
We love those two guys in the Commonwealth Games. And I don't know if it's a peculiar... Maybe they do it in France as well. I can't remember the last Olympics whether it was quite the same, but there is something about it. And I think we Britons, we try everything, and a lot of the time we're hopeless. So we have a kind of fellow feeling for these,
yes,
competitors.
I love... that's the other thing about sport. It's a compelling human story. The story of Emma Raducanu, who's just dropped out of Wimbledon with an injury, is extraordinary. There she was a couple of years ago, won the US Open with this flawless display, and has never hit those heights ever since, and may never again.
Don't think she will. I really don't. I think there's something possibly psychological in her injury issues. She played at Queen's, she got to the final, everyone was saying, look, she's looking terrific, and then just before Wimbledon starts, there was an injury for her. I feel for her, although, as it happens, if you go on the tube, I was on my way to Wimbledon yesterday, and the tube is full of adverts featuring Emma Raducanu. Yes, so yeah. I don't think her bank account's suffering.
No. Giles Corran's just read a good column saying she's got this very, very hard-working advertising career. Occasionally takes a break to play tennis. But it is, that's why, again, it's so moving, these unbelievable athletes behaving like we do. You would have thought they would become machines who never, ever choke. And occasionally... Some of them, like perhaps Djokovic, never do. But they are humans. They do collapse.
The interesting thing about Djokovic, Harry, is never popular because of his robotic abilities. Now there's a flaw simply caused by ageing. He's become much more popular at Wimbledon.
Yeah, so how funny. Yeah, how funny. That's very English, isn't it? And Jim, to go to your career, you started on the Independent, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
40 years ago this year, Harry.
Unbelievable.
40 years ago in October. The first edition.
And did you go straight from university into sports?
No, I worked on a local newspaper, and then I got the job at the Indy when it first started. And wonderful editor, almost as good as you, a guy called Andrew Sutton Smith, who was incredibly encouraging to young talent. And I remember I went, he would give us kind of personal one-on-one chats every so often. And I went for mine, and he said, what would you like to do? And I said, oh, I'd love to do a bit of football. Football's my life. He said, well, go and do it, young man. And that was it. So I went and asked the sports editor, and he gave me some work, and that was it. So
you've been doing general reporting before?
No, when I first joined, I was on the arts page. Well, arts pages. I was on the entertainment page. I was doing the TV section.
Yeah. But that's it. It's amazing. I met lots and lots of... almost always men at university, living in university now in the last couple of years, and very often they say what they'd really like to be is a football journalist. And I always say, why, you know, they're clever people who are interested in football, why don't you do it? And they don't, on the whole, try it. Did you were you obsessed, or were you taking a gamble to do this thing, which is an absolutely wonderful job?
Yes, I remember the first time I did it, Harry. I've just written about the Pinken.
Yes, yeah, that's a lovely piece. If you explain to the listeners what the Pinken
Pinkens were, sports newspapers that local newspapers used to put out, and they it was incredible. This is I'm talking my first association. The Manchester Evening News Football Pink started in 1904, and it used to carry reports of the matches you'd just seen. I mean, extraordinary.
How long did it come out after the game had finished?
You could get it about, maybe there's a bit of misty-eyed nostalgia here. I reckon you could get it in the city centre 45 minutes after the match.
That's unbelievable.
And I used to read it. And, of course, the match report was all about the first half. And it was sort of 15 paragraphs about a 0-0 draw, and then say, and then they scored three. And so I was determined, the first football match I ever covered, I was determined I'm going to do a full coverage thing about it. And in those days, we didn't have laptops, we didn't have the internet. You had to phone your copy through to somebody. And I was sharing the phone. I was watching, my first match was between QPR and Chelsea. And I got my notes together, I knew what I was going to say, and I was sharing the phone with an old hand from the one of the Sundays. And as the final whistle went, he went, full point, par, end of copy. I put his phone down, got his coat, and walked off.
And he had been, he'd been sending it in as he wrote.
As he was
how
going
amazing,
on. And,
yeah. thought,
and these people, they used to have an ability to extemporise while they were going along, and they'd have a kind of innate ability to calculate how many words and so on. And it was an extraordinary skill. And against that, I thought, whoa. But you get used to it. The adrenaline rush is a really interesting thing. You get these incredible games where the situation changes completely at the end. Drama.
And you've got to change the whole tenor of the piece.
You've got to change the whole tenor of the thing.
Yeah.
And you write it. And you're writing it in such a rush, and then you've got a bit of time to make it better for the second edition. Quite often you can't make it better. That adrenaline
rush
has brought words up from the bottom of your soul that you weren't expecting. And actually, it's often better like that. So, yeah, it is a terrific thing. I wonder where we're going with it. It's been really interesting watching this World Cup. I've become a bit of a sort of shortcut man. I've been watching the highlights packages. I've not been staying up all night to watch the matches. In the morning, the BBC has this lovely little panel on iPlayer where you can click onto the night before's matches and see 3 minutes of highlights.
How funny. The young Jim White would never have done that.
No, he'd have thought this was disgraceful.
And why is that? Have you got, in fact, the England's game so far, they have ground out their wins. And
yes, and it? I think it's social media. I think we're getting used to seeing these brisk, hurried highlights. You know, it's Arsenal scoring the goal that gave them the Premier League title. I'm not going to sit through the whole game. I'll just watch that. And I think that's beginning to change things. And I'm not quite sure how the reporter responds to that.
Presumably, in your time, facilities for the press have got that much better. Are they when you began? And it wasn't that long ago, but at the same time, things were much more rickety, were they?
Completely. Yeah. Everything's changed.
Yeah.
I used to do some freelance work before the Indies started for the Times in Fleet Street. It was just off Fleet Street. And what was fascinating then, Harry, this is before your time, the unions had such control that there was no electric typewriters allowed on the premises.
Amazing.
So even the secretary of the editor wasn't allowed an electric typewriter.
Unbelievable.
How, this is archaic.
Because only the unions could use technology.
Exactly.
That the idea? Yeah.
Only the unions could do it. That's why I still type as though I'm on one of those old typewriters thumping away. Yeah.
And you're a big Man United fan, is that right?
I am, yes.
And how do you put that aside when you're doing an objective match report?
Well, it's been quite easy since Sir Alex Ferguson retired because they're usually rubbish. And so you could chastise them with extra venom.
Yeah.
This is a really interesting thing because I see it when I'm watching England in the press box. Everybody wants England to win. And yet they're trying to be objective.
Right.
And there's a kind of unwritten rule, but a spoken rule amongst the journalists that you do not cheer the team you support when you're in the press box. You're there as a neutral observer. Right. And we sometimes look down our noses, we English press corps, at the foreign journalists who turn up in the team's shirts and so on.
Yeah.
I bet you if England win the World Cup final, they'll all be standing up and cheering.
Right, right, yeah.
They can't help themselves.
Funny enough, it's fine if England, you know, all the match reports about England over the World Cup will be inevitably biased, won't they? But it's different with clubs. But I suppose you can just quite easily assume objectivity while inside you're cheering when Man U won the European Cup.
I think if you look at the traditionally, the old commentators would not tell you who they supported, or they would support a less popular team. So John Watson supported Barnet.
Right.
Nobody minded about that.
Right, yeah.
In Glasgow, where every attention to every detail was trying to work out either Spurs or Rangers, Rangers or Celtic bias in the written media, they always claimed that they supported Partick Thistle.
Right.
So if you're a Glasgow press football reporter, you supported Partick Thistle.
And over the years, you must have worked with some of the greats. Do you have a particular sports writer or football writer you admire or admired if they're no longer with us?
I loved Hugh McIlvany. Brian Glanville, when I was growing up, was just incredible. And then he was still there and still... Not that long ago, Brian was in the press box at Arsenal, and magnificently, Brian had never really come to terms with technology. And so, in his latter stages, he would bring his grandson along with him, and he would dictate his copy to his grandson, who would tap it into the laptop.
How funny. Like an old-fashioned copy taker.
Like an old-fashioned copy
taker.
How
funny.
It was magnificent.
And it's difficult with sports writing. You write with great style, but quite often, perhaps unfairly, in Sue's Corner, not you, but some sports writers get into Sue's Corner because they take sport and they start comparing it to Wittgenstein and that sort of thing.
That's right.
Those ones who are in Sue's Corner do take it too far, but actually, you can write very elegiacally about sport without it being pretentious.
Oh, indeed. And the greats, Ian Wooldridge, Hugh McIlvany. Am I going back because I'm getting old?
No.
I think there's some terrific reporters around now. Particularly fond of Paul Heywood, who writes for The Observer now. Absolutely terrific. Paul Heywood, whenever I read his copy, I feel as though I'm there. And that's really what you want.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have to be a claim that a forward has got the touch of Picasso. Paul will just tell you what it was like to be there. And in a sense, that's what you want. You want them to be your eyes in the place. And if you can trust somebody like that, they're doing a great job.
And how does the sports press back get on? I've never done sports writing, but I have done reporting. And actually, I always got on well with other reporters. I thought there was a kind of esprit de corps, except when suddenly there was something up for grabs that they could keep from the rest, which quite understandably, they then became very protective. But actually, everyone got on, and we had very enjoyable times. Is that the same with the sports?
Oh, without doubt.
Yeah.
And in a sense, they are your colleagues rather than the people. They're your rivals, but they're your colleagues rather than the people back in the office. And particularly on tours, all the lads will be together in the US and Mexico at the moment. I remember some of the things I've done in Russia and even in Qatar, the kind of camaraderie of a group of you together and out there is great. And often you're the only representative of your paper there, so therefore these are your colleagues. You know,
right.
They're, But sure. Back in the office, they think they're your deadly rivals, but they're not. They're your friends. But you're right. The moment there is something out there, they try and keep it to themselves.
Yes, and if you've got an exclusive interview with whoever it might be, of course, and everyone respects that, and that's fine,
That's right. And you see, in a way, there are ways in which they kind of police it and make sure that somebody who they don't know isn't coming in on their territory. But as a whole, they're a very engaging bunch. Great stories. Often involve drink, Harry.
Never. Well, that's a very good place to stop. Thanks so much to Jim White for appearing on Radio Aldi. This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.